Like to convene the April 30th, 2013 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Good session. Good morning to all. We have three public hearings this morning, and we've already had cougars, we've had Buffalo Bill, and today we're going to do raccoons. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 474, and welcome to our committee, Senator Olson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt.
Good morning.
Vice Chair McCown. I see Representative Vesco of Alden want to hear this wonderful testimony. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Alan Olson. I'm a state senator. I represent Senate District 20, which runs from Charbonneau to Estacada, from Damascus to Molino, including Gladstone, Oregon City, and Canby, my wonderful hometown. The bill before you today is an extension of House Bill 2175 that was put forward in 2011 by Representative Cowan. And what that bill really looked to do was to prevent habituation of wildlife that would be detrimental to your health, basically. And the bill basically said that we would do bear, cougar, coyote, and wolf. And in that hearing, on the Senate side, we eliminated raccoons. And if you'll notice the picture that was sent to you, raccoons can be extremely furry and cuddly and beautiful when they're out in the wild. But when you start to feed them and habituate them, they can become very nasty. So we, on request, put forward this bill that would add raccoons to the list. Basically, it is a tool for law enforcement. We're not saying that the folks that are out there that like to feed raccoons will go to jail. But what we're saying is that the law enforcement folks have a tool. If the raccoons become a problem for the neighborhood, for the community, then law enforcement will have an item that can go out there and say, could you please cease and desist feeding the raccoons? Beautiful little animals when they're out in the wild, but as you feed them, they become very mean and gnarly, and they want to get into everything. Had a lady, after we passed the Senate Bill 474 on the House side, from Tillamook, wrote to me saying that she had just purchased the house, and the lady prior to that was feeding raccoons, and there was about 40 raccoons around her house.
Oh, my gosh.
So you can see the difficulty that's caused. So this is just a little bit of a help to, for as I said, for law enforcement, so that we can perhaps stop a problem. I know a few folks like raccoons on my side. We have a senator that said that he had a pet and he would sleep with it and take it around, take it fishing and everything else, which would be okay. For those folks that feed their animals outside, feed their cats, their birds, their dogs, this bill does not affect them. It's when they put out food specifically to habituate the raccoons. And with that, I take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for Senator Olson this morning? I'm not seeing any. I think you're getting off easy here.
How nice is that? Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Senator, very much. Great to see you this morning. All right, next I'd like to call up, please, Ron Anglin. And good morning to you.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. We don't have any official prepared testimony this morning. Just would like to talk a little bit about the bill. The original bill that was passed did include raccoons, and it was response. I'm sure most of you remember the lady in Yahats and the bear situation, that we really had a difficult time having a hook under that kind of a bad situation for OSP to be able to encourage the person to stop. And usually when you end up in these big feeding situations, what you end up with is, in the end, dead animals. And raccoons, when they do concentrate in large numbers, it's not unusual to have distemper outbreaks. And, you know, you like to have the people that are feeding them usually like to have lots of raccoons. They think they're cute, and in the end, they end up, all those raccoons end up dying from a distemper outbreak. And then you have problems with potential for distemper in house cats and dogs that have not had the shots. And there's been documentation of raccoons going to the bathroom in the backyard, and there's a real roundworm problem with raccoons that can get into small children when they're playing in the yard. So there's lots of health reasons why concentrations of raccoons is not a good thing. In the end, it's detrimental to the raccoon. And in those kind of situations, this bill would give whether it's city police or Oregon State Police, the ability to work with the department on educating the person, and then if they don't stop, then they have some measures that they can use to cite that are clearer than what the original law was. So with that, in my testimony, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Representative Clem.
Thank you. Ron, there was a word I missed. What was it you said about the original bill?
So the original bill included raccoons in it, and that was from a couple sessions ago, but it was in response to the lady in Yahats that was feeding
crazy
bears.
Crazy bear lady,
yes.
Kissing them and stuff, yeah. So I just looked it up. Can I follow up?
Please.
You know, the original bill had in, I remember this now, it had bear, coyote, deer, elk, feral swine, raccoon, and wild turkey. And it was the House Committee, not the Senate Committee, that took all that out. And we went down to just bear and coyote. Then the bear, and we added in cougar and wolf. And then the Senate added back in coyote. And I don't remember all the testimony at the time, but maybe we'll end up having somebody from law enforcement here to talk about raccoons. But I remember at the time not being persuaded at all that we should be interfering with, you know, people down a country road who want to feed their raccoon. I'm still not really persuaded of that, to be honest, but somebody could probably convince me of it if they give me any actual problems that have occurred.
Yes, Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Hoyt, thank you. I guess I could respond, Representative Clem, to that. We actually had a problem in my home a number of years ago. We moved into a neighborhood. There was an established family of raccoons that moved in under the house, which was a problem. So we took care of that, but the raccoons perpetuated, and we had neighbors who were feeding raccoons, and we had actually at that time brought all our dog food, cat food in the house, trying to fend off this family. And they were charming and they were very cute. And my seventh grade son decided one day that he would go out and play in the backyard with the raccoons, and he was bit by a raccoon. And we spent the afternoon in a doctor's office. We didn't know which of the seven family members it was. Mm-hmm. We couldn't identify which raccoon had actually caused the bite. And so we had to make a decision whether to give him a rabies series, because there had been rabid raccoons in the state within a certain period of time. There had been rabid bats, rabid foxes. Not a lot of raccoons, but it had happened. So we had to make a medical judgment as to whether to give this seventh grader a rabies series or not, which was, there's a risk to the rabies series, but there's a risk that if it is a rabid raccoon, you have a death of a child, because it was a tough decision to make. But we did, and he ended up being fine. But so there can be some significant problems that come with raccoons, in addition to the ones that were mentioned here in testimony. And we ended up having to trap these raccoons, take them way up Marlow Creek, and turn them loose, because they did become a nuisance. And they are cute, and they are fuzzy, and they are wonderful, and they are nice to play with. But there can be problems that arise that are relatively significant.
Very good. Representative Clem?
Representative McKeon, do you live in town?
This was right above the high school on 12th Street.
So, if I might.
Please. Here,
the bill, if I understand it, applies everywhere. And I might be able to get excited about people who live in town probably shouldn't do this because they have lots of neighbors that they might be affecting. Does the bill, do you know if it applies to everywhere or just cities?
Chair Witt, Representative Klim, it's to the whole state, and it gives law enforcement and discretion that in education, if there's a problem, and through education you can't solve that problem, it gives law enforcement at that time an opportunity to cite, a clear opportunity to cite. And what we as an agency typically do is try and educate people, and sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. You know, I had personal experience in Klamath Falls. Klamath Falls has an ordinance that you don't feed wildlife within the city. Just next door to Veterans Park along the lake, there's a fairly nice subdivision and a lot of houses that are just outside the city limits. And I had a lady there that was feeding somewhere around 100 pounds of dog food a week to between 30 and 50 raccoons in her backyard. And those raccoons were scattering throughout the neighborhood and causing all sorts of problems. I had 911 calls at 2:30 in the morning with show quality Jack Russell Terriers under decks with raccoons in that same neighborhood. We've had raccoons when somebody does all of a sudden, and we have documentation from our districts when people quit feeding because they can no longer afford it, and the raccoons are used to getting food, and they will become quite destructive in tearing siding off of houses, going after garbage cans, the whole works, trying to find food, which is similar to what happened in Yahats with the bears, but you're talking about a bunch of cute little raccoons instead of a bigger bear. And it's in those kinds of situations that the discretion would be there for the police to take action if they felt it was appropriate.
Okay. Representative Klim. I'm Krieger. I'm sorry.
Did you? Foreheads, I mean.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I was looking at the vote in the Senate, 16-14. That's kind of strange. And I saw Senator Burdick was a no. You know, I've got to talk to her about why she was a no. Did you have any conversation with any of these people, what they were thinking?
Chair Whip, Representative Krieger, no. We didn't have conversations with them about it.
We've got one of them here, Mr. Chairman. I see him in the back.
Vice Chair McEwen.
Oh, Chair Witt, thank you. And Representative Klim, I think on the Representative Klim, on the issue of whether it's in a city limit or not, yeah. I live within the city limit, or I did at that particular time, but I had a herd of elk that came through my yard every year. I mean, I don't know how you factor it. It's not an urban area when you talk about being in the city. So it's pretty hard to define, I think.
Urban growth boundary?
Yeah. I mean, I have 40 elk in my yard in the fall eating apples, so, and I'm in the city limits. But
the original bill would have made that illegal, by the way.
Yeah. At least we don't have...
I didn't invite them.
They don't just have killer turkeys like they do in Jefferson.
Up. Yeah.
My district, by the way.
Anyone else? Not seeing anyone? Thank you very much, Ron. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Senator Girard.
Now we're going to get our chance to get your question answered.
Well, I'm going to get my question answered now.
I won't even ask.
Hi, I'm Senator Fred Girard. I represent District 9.
Good morning.
Good morning, committee. The vote in the Senate was very close, and the reason it was very close was I'm a raccoon feeder, and so is Senator Thompson.
Uh-oh.
And we had Martha Schrader, who is no longer a senator, was a feeder as well. We live out in the rural parts of the state. My family's been feeding raccoons since the 60s. And I had a pet raccoon, which, believe it or not, was housebroke. His house broke faster than a cat. And it would go fishing with me. And all you had to do is say, do you want to go fishing? And the thing would crawl up your shoulder, and away we would go. So it's different out in the rural part of the state. It truly is. We have relationships with animals that's part of the reason we live out there. We like deer and we like the elk and we actually like bears, you know, but we don't see very many of those. But that's part of living in rural Oregon. And I just think it is wrong to try to legislate something that's a problem within the urban centers, where Portland is the whole crux of this. And that's why Burdick thought maybe, and I can't quote, but I talked to her about it, that she felt that maybe Metro, if Metro had a problem, that Metro could ban these at the local level. But statewide, I just don't think it's a good idea. You know, my passion is that I just don't want to be a felon because I'm not going to quit. It's, like I said, my family, the pet that we had, actually, when we took it out fishing, got pregnant and ended up having a bunch of raccoons around the house. And, yeah, they can be destructive, but pack rats can be destructive, and you shouldn't have your house open underneath, you know, where they're going to take the ducting out. That's, you know, that's really kind of a fault of the house. So I would ask you to not consider that. I don't think they're on the same level of a problem as a pet bear. I can understand that's been a bit much. A pet, you know, nobody that I know of has pet cougars and coyotes and those things that are previously listed. This is a kind of a urban problem. Now, when I was over at Lincoln City, the raccoons came right up on the deck and we fed them there, and that was almost a touristy sort of thing because it was kind of a fun thing to do. So I would ask you to be a no vote. I didn't really campaign against the bill over in the House. It just the vote turned out the way that it did. It was 16-14, and I think it could have been easily defeated. So I'd ask you to defeat it here, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Vice Chair McEwen, are you working on one? No.
I'm really torn on this, Chair Witt. I mean, I have a family member who just relished the raccoons in his yard. He lived in Longview when he was older, and every day, twice a day, he fed raccoons, and it was a wonderful thing he enjoyed very, very much. So I'm torn. I can see both sides of this. I really can.
I own my parents' house, but there's a sign that was on my parents' house, quiet raccoons sleeping. So, I mean, that's just part of the culture. And the biggest problem I have is my neighbors are also feeders, and so we all compete to get the same raccoons, you know. So,
Representative Krieger.
This is another time, Mr. Chair, where there's kind of an urban divide, things that we do in our rural communities that's just natural. We didn't even think anything about it. But yet, if you do the same thing in close proximity and, you know, in these homes, towns, cities, the result is different. And I don't know how many bills we've seen that have dealt with problems in the cities that we end up dealing with it out here because they're having a problem in there, from gangs in Portland to whatever, you know, prostitution in Portland. We had all that stuff in judiciary. It's not happening in Gold Beach. So yet, regulated by it.
Okay.
Representative Reardon?
What are some of the punishments, or what's the sequence of, you know, that someone goes through if you're not cooperative with that Oregon State Patrol person, what happens? I haven't read the statutes.
Anyone?
I don't remember.
Thank you.
It'd be a misdemeanor.
Ron, is that something that you can answer? I don't want to put you on the spot.
You get it in writing first. I remember that. You get a written warning.
The first one is a bite from the raccoon.
There you go.
You get a written warning, but I don't remember the penalty.
Thank you for coming.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Ron Anglin again. I'm probably not the best person to answer the question, but Representative Klim is correct that if there's a documented problem, and that's the key part, is if there's a documented problem, then you try and work with the landowner to address the problem. And if you can do that, in a way that's satisfactory, nothing happens from there. But if the problem were to persist and you needed to take action, then and Representative Krieger might be able to answer this better than me, but I do believe it is a misdemeanor.
1 year, $6,250 is the maximum.
That's the maximum.
How much?
I'm not aware.
$6,250 is the maximum.
I'm not aware of maximums actually being imposed on anything like that. And
$2.
OSP.
$6,250.
OSP obviously would be looking to exercise their discretion on, you know, what's appropriate action to take or not. And you know, certainly there are cases where feeding occurs and there's no problems. There's other cases where there is a problem and OSP does not have a clear path in those kind of cases to deal with it. And the unfortunate thing is, I'd say 9 out of 10 times, the ones that end up suffering the most in the end are, in this case, the raccoons, because they have no mechanism to deal with the distemper. A lot of times the surrounding neighbors are applying for kill permits because they're tired of dealing with the problem, and you end up actually having more harm on the animal that people want to see and enjoy than if they weren't in that kind of a situation.
Representative Whitsett and then Vice Chair Esquivel.
I was wondering about the possibility of an amendment so that it makes rural versus urban, if you will, for this. I don't know, urban growth boundary versus countryside, or I really don't know.
Can I answer that? The cities now have the right to ban feed,
okay,
if they wanted to do it as a local ordinance.
Oh, okay. All right.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Raccoons in the city of Medford are an absolute problem. We have them living in storm drains. We have them living down by Bear Creek. We have them live. I live in the middle of town, and we have problems with raccoons. You have to really watch if you have anything left out, because they will. In fact, a couple of them ran after my wife, and she wasn't real pleased with that. And then it got our cat and ripped our cat pretty badly. But in order to trap them in the state of Oregon, it's not a kill situation. It's a matter of law that you have to terminate that animal. You can't take it out to the past the city limits and let it go, because that's against the law. It is my understanding with the permit process that you have to terminate the animal once you catch it.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, that's correct. We were, in some cases, we were causing problems when we authorized the raccoon to be moved, because if they did have disease problems from being concentrated within the city, then we were introducing that disease out in the wild. And a lot of times, if they were causing a problem in one place, you turn them loose in the wild, they frequently would find somebody else's house and cause a problem there and end up getting shot.
Additional questions or comments, anyone? I'm not seeing any.
No,
gentlemen, thank you very much. Let's see. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Bob Salinger, Deb Schaefer, and Stephen Cafori.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, that crazy bear lady.
That's what
they kicked her out of her house.
Good morning, Representative Witt and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for Portland Audubon Society, and with me today is Deb Schaefer, who's our wildlife veterinarian.
Welcome.
Thank you. I don't actually see this as an urban-rural divide issue. I've worked at Audubon for 20 years. We take in about 3,000 injured animals a year, and we answer about 15,000 wildlife-related phone calls a year. We also work with rehabbers throughout the entire state of Oregon. We have Audubon chapters throughout the entire state of Oregon, and we have problems with raccoon feeding just about everywhere in the state in one way or another. In the metro region, we get calls not just from Portland and Troutdale and Gresham. We get them from Mount Hood, and we get them from outer Clackamas County, and we get them from outer Washington County. We get them all over the place. The problem is that when you feed raccoons, they become habituated to that food. It draws in numbers far larger than typically you would see in the wild. You can get 30, 40, 50 raccoons. We have people call us up and actually request that we subsidize them because they're going through $50 to $100 worth of food a week trying to feed raccoons. Those animals become aggressive toward people, toward pets. They become destructive of property. And also you get disease transmission, as Ron was talking about. You get, if one raccoon has distemper and they're all eating in the same place day after day, they all will get distemper. They all get parvo. When that happens, people either, the neighbors either trap and kill them, or they hire somebody to trap and kill them, or in some cases, they take them out to the country and they release them in the country. I was on the committee that actually recommended to ODF&W to not continue to relocate raccoons. And I'm a person that loves animals. That was a very hard thing for Audubon to do, but we were seeing so much disease transmission in the metropolitan region where people were feeding them, and then they were taking them out to the Columbia River Gorge in Mount Hood and letting them go, and we could actually track distemper outbreaks by predicting where it would break out in the rural areas because we knew where the trappers were dumping them, places like Oxbow Park and the Columbia River Gorge. Some of the testimony we heard was from state parks that the trappers were coming and dumping 20, 30 raccoons into state parks, and it was having a tremendous impact on the habitat and the wildlife there. So it really isn't just an urban-rural issue. What I passed out to you was some things we pulled off the web, and the pile could have easily been 6-7 times larger than it is. I'm not a big fan of wasting paper, but I thought it was important that people really see how universally opposed raccoon feeding is. In the packet, you'll see things from Oregon, California, Washington, Idaho, Montana, humane groups, environmental groups, USDA Wildlife Services, Extension Services, Fish and Wildlife Departments. Virtually everybody recommends feeding raccoons, and I know it's done with the best of intentions. 99% of the time when we work with the public, we can convince them to stop. They apologize, they feel badly, they didn't mean to cause a problem. We only talk to folks that are causing problems. But in a small percentage of the cases, people are causing huge problems, again, urban and rural landscapes, and they refuse to stop. And unfortunately, those are usually the worst cases. Those are the folks that have sort of gone over the edge and are bringing in 40 and 50 raccoons and are unwilling to stop. Since this bill has passed, again, we deal with about 15,000 phone calls a year. We've referred, I think, 2 or 3 coyote situations to state police. We're not referring dozens and dozens, hundreds and hundreds. We're referring a very, very few, very bad situations to state police where we really do need help stopping somebody that's causing a lot of problems. I'll just end by saying it really is heartbreaking. We have seen more raccoons trapped and killed, orphans brought into us because the neighbor's trapping and killing them, killed hundreds of diseased raccoons that were brought in because the disease outbreaks were exacerbated by people feeding them. Again, I'm somebody that cares about animals, but we see a tremendous amount of carnage, property damage, human injuries, pet injuries, because this occurs. And we do need a tool. Education's a primary tool, but we do need a tool where we can stop folks who are really persisting and causing real problems. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ready for me?
Please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Deb Schaefer. As Bob said, I'm the veterinarian at the Audubon Society of Portland. I've been a small animal and a wildlife veterinarian for about over 20 years. So I see both sides of it. I see the pets and the raccoons and how they meet also. As Bob mentioned, at the Wildlife Care Center at Audubon, we get about 15,000 wildlife-related calls per year. At least 10 of those a week are about nuisance raccoons. In the busy time, a lot more than that. So it is a real issue. I'm on the side. I'm seeing where the problems are with feeding. I like raccoons. But again, I see the problems. I'm in the Portland area, but I work with veterinarians all over the state, wildlife veterinarians, and also other wildlife rehabilitation centers and other wildlife professions. And this is not just a Portland area, not just a city problem. It's urban, it's rural, it's everywhere in Portland. We talked about, I think Mr. England and also Mr. Salinger talked about the distemper outbreaks, and I just want to mention it's a horrible, horrible disease, and we do see it spread throughout the state. When we get an outbreak in Portland, I know that the next year it's going to be in Salem, and then we see it throughout throughout all of Oregon. And it's a miserable disease to see these raccoons, and it's hundreds or thousands that we'll see in a year that die from this when there's an outbreak. These are miserable deaths. They're painful. They're really disturbing to see, and there's not a thing we can do about that. That is transmittable to our pets also, the distemper that goes around. So I do have multiple concerns about people feeding raccoons, but today I'm speaking as a veterinarian and mainly about disease transmission, which is my biggest concern. So while there are good intentions with people feeding raccoons, I think this results in several things. First, again, disease transmission within raccoons. I think we see enhanced disease transmission when raccoons are fed between the raccoons and pets. We see that not just with distemper. There's a roundworm that's been mentioned, and there's an emerging disease, leptospirosis, that we're seeing getting into the pet population that's carried by raccoons. It's also a zoonotic potential. People can get that, and it's causes kidney failure. So I just want to mention also that in addition, you know, I feel that feeding raccoons and then causes problems, as Bob mentioned, you know, in where we're feeding them, but also with relocation. And what happens is, I think when they are a nuisance, people relocate them, and the nuisance is caused often by the feeding, and then we get disease spread that way also. And just a reiteration, I don't feel like it's an urban issue. It's an issue everywhere in the state. So I've talked about the disease transmission, kind of my specific concern, but I'm available also if you have other questions. As a wildlife veterinarian, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafouri. I used to have raccoons under my porch in Irvington, which is the heart of the city of Portland, a long ways away from anywhere. And they were fun, but we didn't feed them, and I don't think it's a good idea to feed them. I represent the Wildlife Society, which is the scientific and professional association of wildlife biologists in the state. And obviously these people are concerned about animals or they wouldn't become wildlife biologists in the first place, but they are scientists. And their science experience tells them this is a bad concept to mix domestic animals and wild animals and to mix people and wild animals. I have some testimony that I have emailed to you that's really reiterative of what you've already heard. I won't go through it again, just to say that we support the bill. We think that wildlife has its role, and people have their role in watching wildlife, and they should watch wildlife in their native habitats rather than trying to bring wildlife into their homes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Vice Chair Esquivel.
Not really a question, but more of a statement. I think that I have yet to see a situation of where humans feed animals, except maybe in Wyoming, where they feed the elk every winter. But normally it ends up where the animal ends up paying for it. I've always found that to be the case.
Anyone else? I'd just comment that as someone who lives in a very rural part of our state, there is no difference between rural and urban. The raccoons that are attracted to our neighborhood, while our neighborhood, the distances between homes is probably a lot greater than in most of our urban areas, it's nonetheless a problem. And those raccoons don't stay at one farm. They travel around, and they do become very problematic. And so I agree with each of you, and appreciate your testimony very much, and also appreciate your written submissions, which suggest that this is, I think, as Bob pointed out, universally accepted that this is not a bad, rather this is not a good thing to be doing, and as Vice Chair Esquivel has suggested, the animals generally end up being the ones who suffer from this. So thank you all very, very much. Appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up next, please, Tom Wolf.
What's this have to do with a trout?
Is there anyone else who would like to testify this morning on Senate Bill 474? Not seeing anyone. Tom, good morning.
Morning. Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm not here testifying for Trout Unlimited, but as a landowner living in Orenco, which is at one time a separate little village way in the farm, in the surrounded by rural area when I moved there 30 years ago. And we had a really sweet woman that decided she wanted to feed raccoons, and she became very good at it, and she ended up at one time attracting as many as 50 raccoons. And there was, and you got to understand that at the time that she was doing this, Orenco was a block of houses surrounded by about 5 or 6 miles of farmland away from Hillsborough, and it was in unincorporated Washington County. And it caused a lot of problems. First of all, there was the raccoons became very aggressive, and there were outbreaks where they actually attacked dogs and cats. There was a distemper outbreak, and a lot of time they had to trap and destroy most of those raccoons. It was a very horrible thing, and I love animals, and I understand why some people would want to feed wild animals, but all it does when you, as Chair Witt and others have said, is when you feed them, it causes problems. And I think 474 is a good bill. I'm testifying partially because my car mate is Sue Marshall, and this is her bill, and I'm supportive of that. Partially, it's fun to, even though I respect Senator Olson, I'm not always on the same side with him on some things, so it's good to be on a bill that we're on the same side. And lastly, because I think this is a problem that is not only it's not a rural versus urban, it's a problem that faces across the state, because if you habituate animals, no matter how kindly you may be, how well-meaning you may be, it will cause problems in the long run, because animals, unless there's no other way to deal with it, as a case that Representative Esquivel talked about in Wyoming, they shouldn't be fed. They should be allowed to roam on their own and find their own sources. And when you break that cycle, it causes problems. So I urge you to pass this bill. It is a good bill. It gives a tool to help in dealing with this problem. And I urge that it goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything for Tom? Representative Reardon?
No, just a tip, and he reminded me of it, because I found how I solved my raccoon problem, because they would come up from Johnson Creek, and they'd have a good time, is I quit restocking my fish pond.
Uh-huh.
It works. So.
They're rather efficient at that, too.
They are. They clean
They're
it out
very
well.
Efficient at that.
Anyone else? Tom, thanks very much. Appreciate your testimony. Last and final call on Senate Bill 474 this morning. Anyone else? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 474. And
are we going to work Rocky Raccoon?
I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 571. And Beth, can you tell us a little bit about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 571 would add the State Marine Board Director, or designated representative, and one additional appointed member to the State Invasive Species Council. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. I am going to call up Randy, I think. Okay. Randy Henry and Lisa Debrecare, please. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Randy Henry. I'm the Boating Safety Program Manager for the Oregon State Marine Board. The Oregon Invasive Species Council was created in 2001 by an act of the legislature. At about that same time, the Oregon State Marine Board became increasingly active in working to educate Oregon's boaters about the threat that aquatic invasive species pose to the waterways of the state. The Marine Board and the Invasive Species Council first linked up in about 2003 when they were looking at a marketing campaign to help get the message out sort of broadly across the U.S. to the many different constituency groups, not just related to boating, and but to all facets that could affect invasive species in the state. This has been a very productive relationship. It was certainly an opportunity for the Marine Board to learn the broader sense of the issues out there, as well as taking our specific interests and concerns to a larger group of people who have some of the same concerns that are caused by the proliferation of aquatic invasive species. Because of that relationship, in 2009, when the legislature was pondering various bills, we were able to basically have a road paved when the question came up of dealing specifically with zebra and quagga mussels, and it made putting that bill together that eventually created the Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program much easier and much more effective. And that relationship was very important as we began to roll out and implement that bill. We've had a great 8-year working history with the Invasive Species Council. We've had two different staff members serve on it for the two terms each. I was on for the first 4-year period, and my predecessor, Glenn Dolphin, has been on it up until 2012, but because of term limits, we're no longer able to serve. We are certainly still in the midst and gearing up as we implement the Aquatic Invasive Species Program, not just focused on quagga and zebra mussels, but on the number of aquatic weeds and other invasive fish that are in many of our waterways that boaters have some influence with. So we would like to be able to see that relationship continue, and we would appreciate the opportunity to continue to serve as a permanent council, or as a permanency on the council. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Anything further?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Debrecare. I'm the Oregon Invasive Species Council coordinator, and we just want to say that we fully support this bill. The Oregon Marine Board has been an excellent partner of ours. The bill not only adds them to the council, but it adds an additional member to the council so that we have balance among the state agencies and other representatives and stakeholders in the state of Oregon.
All right. Thank you. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Invasive species in our ecosystem just scares the bejeebers out of me. I'm not sure if we're getting the job done at our port of entries with boats, but you know, if we get the zebra and the quagga mussels in our ecosystem, we have a real problem. I've seen the results of what it's done to California, and also what it's done to the Great Lakes with the zebra mussel shell. There's other invasive species, though. Example, an individual in Florida dumped his, believe it or not, his aquarium in a lake, and that little spindly grass took over the lake to the point where people couldn't drive their boat in that lake. That's how innocent it can be. What are we doing to stop people that are coming into this state from ports of entry that we are inspecting to see if these mussels are in fact attached to their boats, because that's the way it's going to hit us?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, working with the funds that come into the Oregon State Marine Board are through the surcharge on motor boats and manually powered boats. Those funds are divided between the Marine Board for the education, outreach, and some of the study and survey work, but the large portion of the funds go to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to implement specifically that type of border inspection program that you're talking about. When the original bill was passed, we understood that it was not constitutionally acceptable, I guess, to do mandatory stopping authority. But in 2011, the legislature, we figured out how to develop the administrative search procedures, and that was put into statute in 2011. So at this time, I believe we have 5 inspection teams that operate seasonally. They don't operate 24/7, but they operate seasonally during the key times of the year. They have mandatory inspection authority, so when the signs are set up, every every vehicle that's pulling or carrying a boat is required to stop in and have that inspected. There were approximately 4,600 inspections completed in 2012 at the key ports of entry. We had about 70% compliance, meaning that about 70% of the towed vehicles or the vehicles stopped, and we're working with local law enforcement entities to continue to increase that. We're seeing that number increase. Those inspections did yield, I think, about 55 decontaminations, and several of those did include quagga and zebra mussels, as well as other weeds that are currently in the state as invasive species, such as Eurasian water milfoil and parrot's feather and some of those. Are we getting every boat, every vehicle that crosses the border? Not with the program as it's currently established, but it's a far cry better than we had even 2 to 3 years ago. And we're continually working with Department of Fish and Wildlife and other agencies to refine that. These teams also do a great deal of training with the border inspection, with the ODOT inspection crews. If they see commercially hauled vessels that have issues, we continually train Marine Sheriff's deputies across the state to be able to identify and initiate action to address a contaminated vessel. Oregon State Police receives regular training now and is on board in helping to address this issue. And we have a number of studies in place right now to try to look at the internal, I guess. One of my concerns has been, by focusing purely on the borders, we might miss what's going on internally, which is currently a pretty good spread of some of these aquatic grasses that are dumped by aquariums and things like that. We continue to have internal focus on the education outreach piece, as well as enforcement of existing laws that require you to, we call it the Clean Launch Law that was passed in 2007, that prohibits launching a boat if there's any aquatic vegetation at all, any aquatic animals on your boat, motor, or trailer. So there is a lot going on. Could it be made better? It could. It's a funding issue. We're doing as much as we possibly can with the funding, and we're continually improving the program each year.
Oh, please.
Well, nationwide, we spend about $125 billion a year on invasive species, the United States as a whole. And what my concern is, we only need to mess up one time and miss with these, especially the zebra mussel shell. I mean, it's terribly invasive, and it's terrible on your ecosystem, and it literally destroys it. So I would like us to think about as legislators to fund something that's a little more aggressive than what we're doing today, because you're saying we're missing 30%. This is what you're saying.
30% of the boat. Well, we do have enforcement staff on hand. When those people drive by, we do go chase them down. I'm not sure the percentage of all of the ones that we're getting. We don't have state police or county sheriffs at every inspection station every day. There's an education component there. People at first thought, you know, it didn't apply to their suburban carrying canoes on top. Well, they're getting educated that it does include that. And we're trying to work with local folks to make sure that they understand the need to stop at these. So that is increasing. Even in California, where they have a much greater inspection program with established agricultural check stations along their entire eastern border, they figure that they're only 80% effective at stopping all the boats and getting all of the contaminated vessels. It's just to be able to lock it down so you're 100% probably isn't achievable. Getting closer to 80 to 90%, I think, is probably the best you can do. And we still have a ways to get there. So I would agree, you know, additional funding, additional resources would be helpful. But to continually lay that on the boater when there's a number of other issues out there, commercial haulers, docks, heavy equipment, in-water equipment, those sorts of things, aquarium issues, shipping, that sort of thing. There are a number of issues that could contribute to the problem and also contribute to the solution eventually. But that is something that we wrestle with, too.
Thank you. Vice Chair McEwen.
I'm fine, thank you. Beth helped me figure it out.
All right, very good. Representative Woodsett.
I've noted several times passing through Burns that at Riley you have a little stop in the summer to check boats, and I was wondering what exactly you're looking for, the boats coming in from Nevada or from Idaho. because Burns or Riley seems like kind of a weird place.
It's strange. Representative Whitsitt. There actually are some changes in where those stations are going to be located this year. Part of it is, and this would probably be better dealt with by ODFW because they actually manage the inspection program with the funds that we provide to them, but they need to be able to find a suitable location where they can actually set the equipment up. They need to meet ODOT specifications for signage and site distance. You can't just put it anywhere you want to put it, so they have to find a space that's particularly useful for that. Obviously, we want to have a strategic location to get out-of-state boats that are coming in. I think the primary goal is to protect that southern and eastern border where things would be coming from California, Nevada, Utah-infested states, as well as the Great Lakes region, because we get a number of those coming through. But some of the changes that you will see this year is that ODFW is going to relocate two of the inspection station teams from Hines and LeGrand to Lakeview and Ontario. And I think that's to improve that coverage there. And we have a new team, I believe, that's added one inspection team to Gold Beach, and additional inspectors at the Ashland inspection. So we're continuing to beef that up this year.
Thank you.
I share Representative Esquivel's concerns. I think this is one of the greatest threats that we potentially have to some of our natural ecosystems. And I would be very eager to receive any updates that the department might, or the Marine Board might have in terms of what you think would be helpful in making sure that we do not introduce any of these invasives into our states or waterways. I'm also curious, too, I know you mentioned that you get a number of boats that have come perhaps from the Midwest. How long do these species, it may vary probably between animals and plant, but would we typically still have a viable organism if it's coming from the Great Lakes?
Yes, Chair Witt. I believe some of these, like the zebra quagga mussels, can survive in cool, cloudy weather, for up to 30 days. Mm-hmm. I think is the, they will close up and they'll conserve their fluids, and at the next available option, when they're introduced to water, they'll release. The biology is much more complicated than just a one-to-one introduction. Fortunately for us, otherwise I think we'd have them. It can take multiple introductions. It can take the correct sort of water chemistry to really be susceptible to that. So that's helpful, but that certainly doesn't mean that we need to let our guard down at all.
Yes.
We can't really predict where they would do well and how many times it would take for an introduction. So that 30 days is a problem for aquatic weeds. It can be, I suppose, 7 to 10 days, I think, are some numbers I've seen if you're in moist environments. And if you've got a boat with a lot of water in the interior of the boat, different organisms could live in there for a long period of time, too. And that's why we stress through our outreach and education to never launch a dirty boat and always clean, drain, and dry. That's the mantra that we, clean your boat, drain it completely, and let it dry in the sun or however that works to kill those organisms.
Thank you very much. Anything additional? Appreciate your Representative Plum.
Just speaking of introducing invasive species, back in 2009, I introduced a resolution on behalf of the some patients out at the state hospital who were growing in the greenhouse flowers that designated the bachelor button as the mental health recovery flower for the state of Oregon. It might have been Lisa who came by and told me that was an invasive species that I was introducing. A bill to
there you go.
To honor.
At least it wasn't a feral hog.
We let that go. That bill didn't go anywhere.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your appearance today. Anyone else on Senate Bill 571? Not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 571. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 719A. Beth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 719A would modify the basis of the Oregon Sheep Commission's assessment. It would require the commission to levy assessments of no less than 50 cents per head and not more than $1 per head on sheep produced and sold in the state. It prohibits the assessment increase more than 10 cents in a 12-month period. You should have a revenue impact statement, and there is no fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to call forward, please, Reed Anderson and John Fine. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My first to you.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Flip a coin.
I guess I drew the short straw this morning. Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Fine from Roseburg, Oregon. I am currently president of the Oregon Sheep Growers Association and also chairman of the Oregon Sheep Commission. And this bill is being presented as a result of close to 5 years of discussion within the sheep industry in Oregon to make the change from wool in the commission to meat. At one time, when the Oregon Sheep Commission was started in 1977, Oregon was a preeminent sheep production state, and there were large quantities of wool produced, and so the assessment that the sheep producers levied upon themselves was enough to provide money needed to do the education, promotion, and research that the Oregon Sheep Commission is charged to do. In recent years, the number of sheep have been reduced for lots of reasons, and from the standpoint of the Oregon Sheep Commission, wool is a non-perishable product, and so on some years if the market is depressed, then nobody sells it, and so our revenues to the Sheep Commission are not very stable. The national lamb checkoff is on meat and provided for from the American Lamb Board. We believe that by making this change in the state of Oregon that we will have a consistent budget year after year, and because the national lamb checkoff is on meat, that the collection of the assessment will be a more efficient manner. The Oregon Sheep Growers Association at two separate annual conventions has voted to endorse this concept of the change and the 50 cent minimum, and so we are hopeful that this bill will receive your approval and become and pass the House.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm Reed Anderson, sheep producer, Brownsville, Oregon, Linn County, and I'm past president of the Oregon Sheep Growers, and I'm a past chairman of the Oregon Sheep Commission as well. Just to kind of reiterate what Mr. Fine said, we do have, used to be wool was, we all know what our textile industries, what's happened to us in the U.S., and all the textiles now are made abroad, and so with the infrastructure with wool now, there isn't any wool scouring plants, any wool textile industry in the state anymore at all. Most of our raw wool now is shipped out of state. Probably 95% of it is shipped out of state now, which makes it real difficult to try to make any collection of any assessments. And so I'm also on the American Lamb Board, a national checkoff, and we already have a wonderful infrastructure that's put together to make the assessments on lamb and meat, and that seems to be where the sheep industry is focusing more on now is on meat production and instead of wool. So, entertain any questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Where exactly, I see the assessment is anywhere from 50 cents to a maximum of a dollar. So it's a minimum of the bottom end of 50 cents, top is a dollar. Where are we going to start with this? Do we have any clue? Are we going to start at 50 cents? Are we going to start at 60, 75? Because it doesn't say specifically you're going to start at a certain area. It just says a low and a high.
We would start at 50 cents. That's the minimum price. The commission has the opportunity to raise it no more than 10 cents per year.
Right.
And so it would not change for at least a year. And then the members of the commission who are appointed and are sheep producers or involved in the sheep industry in Oregon are the members of the commission, and in the they have that part is basically the same as it is right now as far as the sheep commission now can change the assessment on wool, but only once per year.
Okay. And the reason I asked
does that answer your question? I'm sorry.
Because you were giving a statement. Both of you are giving a statement. I was trying to read this.
I'm sorry.
Exactly what was in that change. So thank you very much. Appreciate the clarification.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, basically the real crux of the change is on what we would be assessing, and obviously the amount that the assessment is on wool would not be at the 50 cent per head rate. Or is not there now.
I have a question.
Anyone else? Representative Whitsitt?
I was just wondering, since Pendleton still puts out a lot of woolen products, who's doing the work if the Pendleton mills are closed? Does it go to Utah, the wool, or where do you sell your wool to? Or the ones who do sell wool, fine.
Well, Representative Whitsitt, Pendleton Company, now they still buy some wools in the state, mm-hmm. but they're just more of a distribution channel now. They'll buy a few of the wools here, and then they'll ship them to the Carolinas or to Texas to have them scoured. Most of the Columbia scouring mill in Portland now is just a receiving station when they import wools from South America, and then they go ahead and ship them across the country.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Well, gentlemen, as we go forward and continue to increase meat production from our state's sheep herds. If you have any calls and you want to do a barbecue here at the state capitol, we'd work closely with you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if any of you had the opportunity, but on April the 9th, we did a luncheon here at the Capitol building to salute agriculture, and the lamb that was a part of that luncheon actually was cooked that morning by Reed and was a part of the funds, the promotional funds from the Oregon Sheep Commission. So I hope that
Excellent.
You had that opportunity to enjoy that luncheon that day.
And I did.
And we plan on doing that again every 2 years like we have in the past. But I hope that you enjoyed it.
Excellent. It was. There is nothing that tastes better than Oregon-grown lamb. Nothing.
We can't disagree with that.
Representative Clem.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Unger and I have a friend who, when it's convenient for her, likes to call herself just a humble shepherd. I wonder, is that a legitimate term anymore? Can she get away with that, or? Yeah, okay.
It probably depends on the friend.
Well said.
All right. Anything else? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you for
your testimony. Anyone else today on Senate Bill 719? Not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 719A.
Candidates for a better day in the agriculture and fisheries.
Coming events, Beth.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on Thursday, May 2nd, you will have two public hearings, one on Senate Bill 199, which addresses the split season lease program at the Water Resources Department, and then Senate Bill 200, which would allow a record landowner to apply to have part or all of their water right assigned, which would allow them to move forward with a water rights certification process. And then there are four work sessions scheduled on bills you've already heard, Senate Bill 25A that deals with charter boats, Senate Bill 26 that is the Marine Board grant bill that you talked about last week, Senate Bill 31 deals with forest land classification committees, and Senate Bill 198, which is the bill that addresses revocation of fishing licenses by courts.
Very good. And our starting time on Thursday will be?
9 a.m.
9 a.m. Okay. Anything else for the good of the order? Not seeing any. We're adjourned. Thank you very much, committee members.
Thank you. Thank you.